As a plant-based cheese company, Daiya has never talked about beef in an ad before, because someone somewhere once had a beef with saying beef and plant-based together. So putting a slice of Daiya cheese on a beef burger, not okay. Well, our delicious melty cheese has a beef with your beef about beef, because any step towards plant-forward eating is a step in the right direction. Daiya, 100% plant-based, even if you're not. Now made with Daiya Oat Cream Blend.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
It's 2019. It's 2019. Yeah, it's 2019. Which is it?
I think we said 2019.
It sounds cooler.
We had a couple of good bits of good news over the break, did we not? We had the news that all our podcasts are now on Spotify.
Yeah.
Which is the second biggest after iTunes place now, where people get their... It's where the young people get their podcasts, I'm reliably informed.
When the younger people are looking for something about Anthony Pohl, it's to Spotify. It's to Spotify they turn them. Okay, yeah. Good.
The second bit of good news is that the Anthony Pohl episode has been the most successful one we've done. And we think that might be connected to Spotify.
But I'm absolutely delighted. I really enjoyed it on the night, that episode. But also the thought that it's going out there around the world and it's being streamed on the same platform as Kanye West and Taylor Swift.
Ed Sheeran.
It's very pleasing. So did you get any nice books for Christmas?
No. I didn't get any books. I got some nice books for Christmas. I got all my Elizabeth Taylors and I got Proust.
Have you read any Elizabeth Taylor?
Love it, of course. It's like a sharp kind of glass of vodka after the foaming ale of Lawrence, I have to say.
Whoa!
And you started Proust. Reading In Search of Lost Time. Which translation have you?
I mean, I've only read a little bit, but I was expecting it to start with somebody dunking a biscuit and it doesn't.
A rich tea in a cup.
That's what Lawrence would do. Which translation have you got?
Scott Moncrief, that's the Kilmartin, yeah. It's the one that vintage too.
I've already put the screw on John by saying to him, if you get through it, then that's our Christmas episode for 2019. What a thought! An hour of lighthearted chat about In Search of Lost Time, but it would be great to do it.
Yeah. Maybe we should get Alain de Botton.
Certainly ambitious.
Catherine, did you get any nice books for Christmas?
Well, I actually don't tend to receive books for Christmas. I think perhaps my family and friends think I already have too many books. Of course, you can never have too many books, but I did receive one book. Henry Green's last novel, Doting, published in 1952. Have you done Henry Green on the Unbacklisted?
We've tried.
We've tried.
We have an empty chair, like Tiny Tim's.
Okay. Doting is probably not his best known. I think his best known is the books that are packaged together as a trilogy, Living, Loving and Party Going.
Yeah.
But Doting, interestingly, he died about 20 years after it was published and he never wrote another novel. It's about a middle-aged woman and a younger woman who sort of run rings around this civil servant who's married to the old woman. I have to say I haven't started it yet, but I do love his experimental writing. I think he wrote... once about writing that it was the act of writing was a direct intimacy between the writer and a stranger, and I think that's quite a lovely phrase.
It was a very nice edition. Of Pohl as well,
and Evelyn Waugh. So they're all part of that Eton Oxford cabal.
Rachel, did you get any nice books for Christmas?
I got bought a copy of Melmoth by Sarah Perry, which I've been dying to read. And which I have not yet started because I've been busy with rereading Lawrence.
I read a book at Christmas which I absolutely loved, which is Watling Street by John Higgs. It's a book I've been reading.
I've read that book and I've interviewed John about that.
Tell us about it.
It's a Watling Street is the road that runs from Dover to Anglesey, one of the five ancient pathways of prehistoric Britain. And he does what could be, you know, a run-of-the-mill psychogeographic journey, but it's much more interesting that. It's a sort of reflection on Brexit, on Britain, on divided Britain, on the future, on the nature of what he calls Teilhard de Chardin's brilliant term, the noosphere, which is the kind of symbolic. I mean, you know, there's the biosphere where animals and plants live, and then there's the noosphere, which is the place of ideas, which is where human culture lives. And he talks about the noosphere of Albion, the old name for the islands of Britain. It's there's a fantastic bit, and I was telling the boys last night, of where he goes to interview Alan Moore in his house in Northampton, and there's a picture of Alan Moore with his kind of snake's head stick pointing at an empty bit of ground next to Superior Carl's garage. It's like, this is the absolute centre of it. it's a really good book. I devoured it, I have to say. I haven't read a book of that kind that I've enjoyed so much for a long time.
Only got three books which I think map the territory of my psyche and personality absolutely perfectly. They are Paintings in Proust by Eric Carpleys, which goes through In Search of Lost Time in the order in which these paintings appear, talks about each painting or painter that's mentioned by Proust and reproduces the painting, right? And so you can either dip into it, it's quite interesting to dip into, but if you read through it after you've read In Search of Lost Time from cover to cover, it's like a sort of brilliant whistle-stop tour through this 3,000-page book. I really loved reading it. It was the perfect way to see out the end of that year of reading it, right? So I'm saying to you, great, John, you know, don't buy it this year, because maybe I'll get it for you for Christmas.
Excellent.
This year, at the end of the year. The second of my three books was the Beastie Boys book.
Brilliant.
Which is fantastic. Yeah. As a pop book, hip-hop book, I'm sure they put it together. Whoever helped them do it has really got the feel of Grand Royal magazine in the 90s, which is the magazine that they published. It is really funny. It's full of loads of good photos. It's great. And also, it's got an incredibly moving ending. They've done a thing for their deceased colleague, which is just beautiful and really brings a tear to the eye. So that's really great. And then my third book was the folio edition of Robert Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy.
So actually, I was the publisher of that particular edition.
Oh my God.
I now have to confess.
How fantastic.
And that is a coincidence. That's a total coincidence.
It's a coincidence.
Funny enough, that is on my TBR list for this year, because I have a feeling that we might be able to squeeze an actual episode.
Well, you could probably ask Philip Pullman to come in, because I commissioned the introduction from him.
That was one of my cunning plans.
So it's mentioned, it's a big part of A Dance to the Music of Time.
Yeah.
And because I've finished A Dance to the Music of Time, because I finished In Search of Lost Time, I wanted a substantial reading project for the year. Anatomy of Melancholy is a big old
It's a big unit.
Three volumes. And it is in fact out of print. So sourcing it proved challenging for the person concerned, but they did it.
I'm really pleased you got it.
Yeah.
I could suggest Hobbes's Leviathan if you want a big project to read for 2021, if you haven't got anything else coming up.
So I suppose we ought to get on with the actual podcast. This is just the warm up, Nick. This is just the warm up.
Shall we start?
Sorry, Nick.
Yeah.
Thank you. I've got seven books, because I asked for books. You have to guess. I got probably the book that I think most people got this Christmas.
Normal People.
Apart from that.
She's already read Normal
Not
People.
Really. Michelle Obama.
Yes, Michelle.
That
Obama.
Was the Christmas. Was that the best selling book in?
I think it was.
Yeah.
I read it. And very enlightening, actually. Very good.
So thumbs up for that.
Thumbs up for Michelle Obama. Also thumbs up for the Lily Allen
book. Now, I hear that's really great, the Lily Allen book.
It's no shame. Yeah, it's good. And it's also interesting because it's about she's positioning herself as a narcissist, but interestingly enough, as a pop star who does things that male pop stars are acceptable.
Right.
Females, it's considered not acceptable. So that's what I say. Interesting.
She's very interesting. Very interesting.
Do you think your year of producing Backlisted has resulted in an upswing in the quantity of books that you got?
I mean, by about 600%.
One perfect. One person at a time, Andy. Shall we start? Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. Today you join us as we stand on a hill looking down on the rich, marshy grasslands of the Midlands, a church tower illuminated by moonlight, the wind at our backs, the dome of stars shining down on us, the call of a lone owl quickening our blood.
God almighty.
I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound, the platform where readers crowdfund the books they really want to read.
I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And joining us today are two returning guests, Rachel Kerr, publisher and editor, former publicity director of Jonathan Cape, marketing director of Picador and Harville, now editor-at-large for Unbound, who joined us for the Charles Sprawson episode on Haunts of the Black Masseur. And full disclosure that she is married to the man, John Mitchinson. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Okay, good, good. Okay. And we're also joined by Catherine Taylor.
Oh, hello.
Hello, Catherine Taylor. Catherine Taylor is a writer and critic who contributes regularly to the FT, The Guardian, The Economist, The TLS, The New Statesman and The Irish Times, and is a judge for the 2019 Republic of Consciousness Prize and commercial director for the brilliant Brixton Review of Books. And Catherine is a returning guest. She last joined us to talk eloquently about Vladimir Nabokov's The Gift, which was for some time our most popular episode and is still one of our most popular episodes.
The book that Rachel and Catherine are here to talk about is The Rainbow by D.H. Lawrence, first published by Methuen in 1915, which, with its sequel Women in Love, is widely considered to be Lawrence's crowning achievement as a writer.
I'm just going to say, John and I had a very nice, appropriate enough, Mexican meal before Christmas where we talked about what books we might do in the year ahead and guests that we might ask. And John has wanted to do Lawrence and I think The Rainbow ever since we started doing Backlisted. So I was very up for that. And I was thinking, you know what, this will be great fun. Great, great. I come to Lawrence as a relative newcomer, but it'd be good to challenge my prejudices. And then we had this lovely meal and we were walking back to the tube and John went, in a bid to sell it to me, he said, the thing about The Rainbow, Andy, is it's the one of D.H. Lawrence's books where he's channeling Thomas Hardy. and at which point I knew I was in trouble. A novelist I'm not sure about channels a novelist I really struggle with.
Yeah.
But we'll come on to that soon.
We will come on to it. And I mean, it's also one of the reasons for doing it. It's not an obvious choice, obviously. There are many more obscure books than The Rainbow. It's one of the classic English novel, but it was a book that I'd read a long time ago and hadn't reread, and it had been one of my favourites. And I just felt that Andy and I had glanced around it. There are so many, over so many previous podcasts that it would be a good moment to dust off the old copy and see whether it stood up to scrutiny, which we will find out with the help of our guests in a moment.
Before we get on to that, we asked people earlier in the week to tell us about the best old book or backlist book that they read in 2018. And we got like dozens and dozens of responses to this. I wish I could read it. We can't return all your paintings, sadly. But we can read out a few of these tweets. So I'm going to read out a few of these and see what the panel, be kind, everybody, makes of these as suggestions of books. But also, if you're listening at home and you have a pen and a piece of paper to hand, it's probably worth jotting some of these down. I certainly want to read some of these based on the enthusiasm with which they've been recommended by listeners. So here we go, John. The first one that I've highlighted here is Matthew Adams. Hello, Matthew. Matthew suggested we read The Journal of a Disappointed Man by W.N.P. Barbellion.
I mean, it's your pinned tweet, isn't it? A quote from that book.
It has been for some time, yes. And in fact, I think it was mentioned on the very first episode of Backlisted.
I think it was mentioned in the
jail. In addition to Matthew, if you're out there and you have a deep, abiding love of The Journal of a Disappointed Man, contact me. Contact me. I'm saying you might get lucky this year, right? So here we go. Linda recommends Living Alone by Stella Benson. Written in 1917, The War as Magic Realism, completely delightful and melancholy.
Wow.
That sounds
marvellous.
I've just
never heard of that. That's amazing.
You know, one of the things I found about these when people sent them in is how few of them I had heard of.
That's
yeah,
brilliant.
It was. I mean, I totally agree. It was a real revelation, actually, that the list. And I mean, I've jotted loads down.
You've got one there?
I have got one here. It wasn't exactly from that tweet, but I was struck by Neil Mudd's trope. Hello, Neil. Disastrous lifestyle choices, check. Gifted but obscure writer, check. Dead, check. Annika Van sounds like a prime candidate for the Backlisted Pod treatment.
Well, truth is, we've nearly done Annika Van at least a couple of times.
There's a new anthology in the offing, yeah. So...
Claudia Watkins recommends Mrs. Eckdorf in O'Neill's Hotel by William Trevor, which she says is beautifully written and intriguing, atmospheric, sad and funny, and amazing. Jill Hopper at Jill Hopper One says The Kon-Tiki Expedition by Tor Heyerdahl, an adventure that made my hair stand on end. Sharks and ships. Nikki's read it. And?
Yeah, it's good. Very adventurous.
What I remember about that book is that book was on my parents' bookshelves and the bookshelves of all my parents' friends
and
when I was growing up.
My parents' bookshelves too.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you remember it?
I went to see the there was a film of the... I remember taking my brother to the cinema to see the film of that.
David Millington, who is at Green Corrie, suggested a book I love, which I'd forgotten about, Mythago Wood by Robert Holstock.
I've never heard of it. A couple of people unfamiliar with my work have suggested books by Somerset Maugham. And I just have to break it to you that it's never going to happen.
Oh, come on.
Start your own
bondage,
start
come
your
on.
Own podcasts to do Somerset Maugham because it ain't happening on Backlisted. Here's a good one. Gone with the Wind. Says Jackie, read this, lying by the pool in Kos, but being transported to the Deep South during the American Civil War, probably the biggest read of my life at 998 pages, but an ideal holiday read and a great page turner.
I have read it. And you know, I think it's interesting. It's one of those books that so many people probably haven't read because they just associate it with the film.
And?
It's a brilliant book.
Okay.
Here's P. Lowe, which is P-Lowe, who recommends a book which I do love, Narrowboat by L.T.C. Rolt. He says, recommended for shepherd fanciers like John. It's very much in the tone of whichever book he recommended that mentions selling goldfinches in the paper bags.
Oh,
in a good way.
Wonderful recommendation. We've got Joel
Pinkney here.
Oh, yeah.
He recommends The Bridge of Beyond by Simone Schwartz-Bart, originally published in 1972 and reissued by NYRB Classics, an astonishingly well-told story of several generations of women on the Caribbean island of Guadeloupe, much about the legacies of slavery. Gorgeous, heart-rending book.
Oh, that sounds great.
That sounds good. There's so many of these, because the novelist Claire Fuller, she got in touch. She said The Wall by Marlon Haushofer.
Yeah.
Translated from the German by our friend Sean Whiteside, our listener Sean Whiteside. Yeah. First published in 1968, a woman finds herself stuck in the Alps behind an invisible wall. Brilliant book and made into a fine film too. Jonathan Gibbs, our former guest, the novelist Jonathan Gibbs, says The Black Prince by Iris Murdoch is my favourite old book of the year. Old, well, it's a year younger than me, so go figure. It brilliantly showcases her ability to mix high and low, serious and ludicrous in the same book. And Catherine Taylor, at Catcher Taylor, replied to Jonathan saying, hooray.
Well, that's because I wrote an essay on The Black Prince for the second issue of the Brixton Review of Books last year.
Did you? Oh, we can get you back in again.
No,
fantastic.
Tony Cross at Lobster71, Bid Me to Live by HD, A Story of World War
I.
Can we do that, please?
Yeah.
I love that book.
Yeah.
And her.
Said it would make a good double bill with Richard Aldington's Death of a Hero, which rather, you know. Aldington was a great mate of D.H. Lawrence.
James Doerser at James Doerser. Mrs. Bridge by Evan S. Connell, 1959. Yeah. Something that might conceivably be grouped with that run of books you've had with sharply observed female protagonists using what agency they have in suffocating patriarchy, sweet and tragic with a crafty structure. Anna Maria Tuckett says, I read two novels by Dorothy Whipple, The Priory, and They Were Sisters, and enjoyed them very much. I was rather crushed to hear Carmen Khalil's low opinion of Whipple on the Elizabeth Jenkins episode.
I'm afraid I share Carmen Khalil's low opinion.
I'm doing two more and then we'll move on to the main event. Professor Laura Vaughan, I'd nominate The L-Shaped Room.
Yes.
Thank you, Professor Laura Vaughan. I absolutely would love to do that book on here. By Lynn Reed Banks, which I reread last year for the umpteenth time. Its depiction of unmarried pregnancy at a time well within living memory is astonishing, as is the characterful description of Bedsit Land in Fulham. You're singing my song, Professor Laura Vaughan.
It's terrific, and it's the first of a trilogy.
And finally, Caroline Raphael.
Yes.
Our friend Caroline Raphael says, The Humbler Creation. Everyone, I'm seeing if anybody knows who that's by. Anybody know who that's by? Pamela Hansford-Johnson.
Yes.
I did. Taut, crisp, and agonising story of a marriage against late 1950s London backdrop. These look terrific as well. I think, haven't Pamela Hansford-Johnson's novels, aren't they being reissued at the moment? I believe they might be. I think they might be. Yes, I believe that's right. Anyway, listen, thanks very much, everybody. What we might try and do is put that full list up on our Facebook page on the website.
We will excavate it and put it up as a document on the website.
So thank you so much for all your recommendations. And also, apart from the two people who nominated Somerset Maugham, thank you for your... thank you for your nominations. Because Nikki's got her head in her hands now. Don't be mean to the listeners, Andy. I don't like Somerset Maugham, which happens to dovetail with the author we've gathered here to talk
about. And we're here to talk about Lawrence.
Hey, it can't all be book chat. Smoke Chesterfields.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Are you looking for a view of the world that's a bit different? Hi, I'm Jason Palmer, a host of The Weekend Intelligence, a podcast from The Economist. Join us to hear the stories that matter most to our correspondents and editors. Every Saturday, we introduce you to people and ideas that take you outside the ordinary and expand your horizons one episode at a time. Join us and see the world from a new perspective. To listen free until May 31st, search Spotify for The Weekend Intelligence.
I wonder if it would be, I mean, people who haven't read The Rainbow, a little bit of context. It was published in 1915. It was very rapidly impounded. It was withdrawn from sale as obscene, and it wasn't available again for another 10 years.
We had a little chat before we started today, and nobody wants to hear me bang on for an hour about my prejudices against T.H. Lawrence. Some of which were overturned by reading the book, I have to say.
Yeah.
What I think is interesting is that Lawrence is an author who has always polarised readers for 100 years, basically, and continues to do so now, and for different reasons. It's such a strong flavour, such a strong personality coming through the writing. And so our panel here is made up of sort of all points of the compass, I think, of how people have felt about Lawrence at various points or feel about Lawrence now. Rachel, can you remember the first time you read Lawrence or The Rainbow?
I first read The Rainbow when I was an undergraduate, and I loved it so much, and I loved his work so much that when I went on to do postgraduate study, I had to write a dissertation, a sort of 10,000-word dissertation. And so you had to choose a subject for that. And I was desperate to do D.H. Lawrence because I wanted to read everything. I wanted to read all the supporting, you know, all his letters and everything. I wanted to know more about him. And I went to my tutor, the very estimable and wonderful Judith Chernick at Queen Mary College, Mile End. And the sense of palpable distress when I suggested that I was going to do Lawrence, the sort of dismal oh God, do you have to? I said, yeah, I'm really sorry, but I really, really do want to do. And she said, come on, which, you know, you better focus on a novel. Which novel are you going to focus on? I went, I'm really sorry, but it's going to be Lady Chatterley's Lover, at which point she looked even more distressed. And over the course of the next 2 years, I probably caused her more upset than anything else. But we came to an agreement that in the end, you know, I had helped her enjoy it more, and she had helped me temper my rather passionate feelings about D.H. Lawrence into something a little more critically cool. And it was a fantastic experience for me. And the only reason I could do that was that at the time there were three versions of Lady Chatterley's Lover in print with Penguin. I don't know if they are still in print in the same, but because the way, well, we can talk about this later, but the way Lawrence wrote was that he would write a whole manuscript and then he would go, I hate that, and start again, not to go back and edit in any way. So it was obviously very good training for me as a future editor of books myself, was that I was looking at his writing methods as much as anything else. which of course ends up with you comparing and contrasting three different versions of Connie's orgasm and the terrible, terrible dark secret moments.
I don't want to do that. Catherine, when did you first read The Rainbow?
I think I was about just before I went to university. So I must have been 16 or 17. My mother was a huge Lawrence fan, and I'd like to mention Thomas Hardy. Sorry, Andy. Also a huge fan of Thomas Hardy, and I do see this book as, you know, is aping Hardy to some extent as part of that English rural tradition writing. And I did love The Rainbow. I'd really not got on with Lawrence. I hated Sons and Lovers. I think I might have been forced to read it at school.
I found it
extraordinarily turgid and with all those sexist tropes that have been levelled at Lawrence. But I think what's interesting about The Rainbow, which I revisited last year because I wrote an essay on it for a book called Literary Landscapes, was that I'd forgotten that it was set so near to where I grew up. So it's on Derbyshire, Nottinghamshire border, the Erewash Valley. It's a book that runs from about the 1840s to 1905, so it's sort of pre-industrialisation, but it also, it really focuses on Lawrence's attitude towards mass industrialisation. And also, he puts aspects of himself in the book. I would say that the last part of the book, which focuses on Ursula Brangwen, who is the third generation of the Brangwen family, the farming family that is being focused on in this book. And I think one of the reasons it was banned, because obviously there's frank sex, there's sex between women, etc., there's unmarried sex.
It was Anna dancing naked in front of the mirror that was seen when it was up in the Bow Street Magistrates Court. Episode. That was one of the pieces that was
pregnant
read
out. And dancing.
Pregnant and dancing. How dare she?
In her own bedroom.
But I think Lawrence,
by herself.
I think it's a book about Lawrence's own coming of age in a way that Sons and Lovers is, but he puts himself, I think, into the character of Ursula and perhaps couldn't write about some of the things that she experienced as a man writing about some of his own inclinations, perhaps. So when I revisited it, I found it was marvellous. I just thought some of the episodes he's writing about the natural world, about the passion and tenderness between, particularly between Anna and her husband, their wedding, the few days that they are closeted together, and also about the battle between, in this case, men and women in relationships, was something that I didn't actually find sexist. I just find it very honest. And yeah, he does go off into these sort of the purple prose of his, let's just say, sort of shamanistic beliefs.
I would like to ask John, actually, I don't actually get to ask John this, but because it's this book, where were you when you first read The Rainbow?
Okay, so I was in Auckland in New Zealand, and I'd read Women in Love and I'd not got on with it. I just finished school, you know, precocious, read Ulysses at school, thought I wanted to be, you know, a writer like Joyce because he was brilliant. Very embarrassing. And read Lawrence, and I thought, this is terrible. This bloke can't write. He's maundering on endlessly. And then something happened. The penny dropped at some point. I watched the Ken Russell film, which is mad, of Women in Love. I mean, it's iconic, but mad.
We'll come on to it. Keep going.
I discovered some of his short stories, England, My England, and then I discovered the poetry, and then I had a kind of revelation about Lawrence. I felt it's like taking George Eliot and Hardy and Dickens and putting all the kind of, particularly those novels, even a bit of Jane Austen, and then suddenly just letting it explode. I felt a release. So I read The Rainbow and I completely fell in love with it. And the thing that we all don't like about Lawrence is the hectoring, being shouted at loudly and poked repeatedly in the chest by a man who's got kind of very, very strong ideas about sexuality, about religion.
He may have issues, yes.
And basically, I think all his novels are this, aren't they? They're kind of what he calls the metaphysic, the ideas that animate them. The key one in The Rainbow and Women in Love is the idea of, you know, man, woman, there needs to be a trinity, a mechanical modern world as opposed to the natural world. The novel is some kind of way of combining ideas about the world with character. When he says that philosophy, religion and science are all of them busy nailing things down to get a stable equilibrium. Religion with its nailed down one God who says thou shalt, thou shan't, and hammers home every time. Philosophy with its fixed ideas, science with its laws. They all of them all the time want to nail us onto some tree or other. But the novel, no. The novel is the highest example of subtle interrelatedness that man has yet discovered. Everything is true in its own time, place, circumstance, and untrue out of its own place, time, circumstance. If you try to nail anything down in the novel, it either kills the novel or the novel gets up and walks away with the nail. which is and that's also
that's great.
Lawrence is I think he's a brilliant critic. What you get in The Sense of the Rainbow is like the marriages go wrong before they go right. Relentless, endless sort of pattern of things going wrong and people not understanding one another. And one moment everything seems to be going well, and then suddenly, you know.
Was it your favourite novel, though?
It was for a long time. Well, I used to say it was, in the way that I used to say that Shake Some Action was my favourite song.
Flaming Groovies.
Yeah. I mean, it's still a great song. I still think The Rainbow is a great novel.
So, what we're going to do now is we're going to raise a glass to D.H. Lawrence. Yeah. I feel like we're welcoming him in, right? Yes. And we've got a clip here. So we've got someone who's going to lead the toast for us. There's a prize if you can tell me who this is.
Here's the first of the day, fellas. To old D.H. Lawrence. Nick, Nick, Nick. Indians.
Name that film. Name that film.
It's Jack Nicholson.
It is Jack Nicholson in
Five of His Easy Pieces. No.
Oh, he's so close, but he's not right. It's an Easy Rider.
Easy Rider. Of course it is. Of course it is. In a funny kind of way, the difficulty in Lawrence is sort of the point. I think anyone who is interested in fiction, there is stuff to be gained from The Rainbow. But if you're a pointillist, if you like beautiful, accurate, delicate, it psychologically kind of turns sense, then this is not the book for you, and it never
what
will
are you
be.
Saying? What are you looking at me while you say that?
Yes, Andy. Well, come on, I think you need to say something.
All right, I'll say very quickly. What I'm going to say is I don't want to say why I don't like D.H. Lawrence, because I think when I was working on my last book, it really changed how I read. And one of the things that it really changed for me is I'm reluctant to get hung up on whether I enjoy a book or not.
Mm.
Right? Because I think we can't enjoy everything. And actually, enjoyment is an overrated element. It's not to be discounted, it's important. But when it comes down to it, there are just some writers whose prose you can't work with because of your particular makeup, right? And I had not read Lawrence properly until last year. I read Sons and Lovers, and I thought, okay, this is okay, but I'm having to kind of muscle past the gag reflex in order to get this down, right? This is not my taste.
Mm.
And going into The Rainbow, I was sort of horrible for me because I was thinking, I'm just not enjoying this. This is too earnest and too purple. So however I might appreciate it in principle with my knowledge of the history of the English novel, with my reading of Jeff Dyer to help me identify what's good and what isn't so good, when it comes down to it, and this is as sophisticated as I'm going to get, I just don't like it.
Yeah.
I can educate myself to try and appreciate it, and that's what I should do. That's what I should do. I don't have any time.
Well, I don't think there's any should about it,
you can't. Otherwise, you get trapped, don't you? You get trapped in a kind of thinking, oh, I like this, I don't like that. That's fine, but...
But you've given it a good go, Andy.
I have tried.
You've given it a good go.
I've watched Women in Love. We can talk about Women in Love as well, which I went into Catherine thinking, oh, I like Ken Russell. Ken Russell's film about Debussy with Oliver Reed is one of my favourite things. And yet it seemed like the absolute hellish coming together of... I just thought,
The problem with Women in Love is that it sort of becomes a parody of the book. And I would argue that book, I think, Pat, John, you had that a reaction to Women in Love when you read it. You read it before The Rainbow, as I did. It sort of spoils it. And I think so many people don't tend to read Lawrence, so they don't read the books. They see a film like that.
I think that's very true, because I think I'd already seen the film of Women in Love when I first read The Rainbow. And I read The Rainbow first, and I was really... I think that's part of why I loved it so much, because it was nothing like that film.
Who can forget Glenda Jackson as Gudrun?
I know. I mean, you know, beautiful to look at, but sort of horrible in every way. You know, I hadn't really enjoyed Sons and Lovers either. I'd found that really tricky.
Mm. I would call that earnestness in the history.
But somehow, just the sheer kind of beauty, if you just let the language kind of wash over you,
and
you just, and the structure and everything else, it's all very beautiful. And what I love most about The Rainbow, and what really got me at the time, and still actually, you know, 30 odd years later, I'm reading it again, and what really makes it sort of sing for me is the attempt, sometimes successful and sometimes not so, to give inarticulate people voice and and understanding of their own feelings, which I think is a wonderful thing to be trying to do. And I love the men are warm and attached to the soil, and the blood in the teats of the cows, and the it's the women who are looking.
For those who can't see it, Rachel is actually milking something here.
I'm miming. But it's I love all that. I love the fact that the women are outward looking, and that is not yet. I mean, he gets later in his writing career, the opposition between men and women gets much more. Women are sharp and outward looking and difficult, and men are sort of destroyed by it. Whereas at this point, they're in a balance.
I think what I took from rereading it was that it seemed to me as radical as it must have seemed when it was published and then, you know, almost immediately revoked, as it were, in 1915. And to sort of put it in context, that same year, Virginia Woolf published her first novel, The Voyage Out. And around that time, Dorothy Richardson was publishing her extraordinary sequence of novels, which became Pilgrimage. And also it was published in the middle, well, the beginning, sorry, of the First World War. And he was a conscientious objector. Mm. He
harried out of the country.
Harried out of the country. And also, well, you mentioned, obviously, Jeff Dyer's book, Out of Sheer Rage, about Lawrence. He's had such an influence on so many different kinds of writers. Helen Dunmore's novel, Zen or in Darkness, which is about D.H. Lawrence and his German wife, who was also a divorcee, they're living in Cornwall during the First World War, and how they were targeted as spies by the establishment. So
her cousin was the Red Baron.
Yeah. Richthofen. Richthofen.
Yeah. I'm just going to read the blurb on the back of your edition, Catherine, of this. This is how Penguin sold you the rainbow.
In about the 70s,
I think. Yeah.
This is my family edition.
Yeah, yeah. His classic story of a family of Midland farmers.
It's terrific, isn't it? It's like the comic strip presents.
Yeah, and
the
tides of passion and conflict within them. A vigorous and strong-willed breed. The Brangwens have been established for generations as a yeoman family on the borders of Nottinghamshire among the coal mines. When Tom Brangwen marries a Polish widow, he discovers that love must struggle to come to terms with the other forces that go to make up a human personality.
To which you think, A.
That's not really adequate. Sorry, whoever wrote that then. Yeah. But, you know. So I was looking around for positives to accentuate in my experience. And I found a couple that I wanted to share with you. The first is that I found this brilliant documentary about Lawrence that was made in the mid-80s, a South Bank show that was made. They commissioned Anthony Burgess to make a film about Lawrence.
Oh, my Lord, did they really?
And we've got a clip from that here. There's a thing in here where I found, I thought I could really, this Lawrence I could really get with.
When he published his first books, the Bloomsbury intellectuals like E.M. Forster, Bertrand Russell and Lady Ottoline Morell patronised him. And he responded by satirising them in his books. Lady Ottoline Morell especially, an aristocratic lady, passionate, possessive, with no talent at all except for self-exhibition. Lawrence was a provincial man, a man of the working classes. In a sense, he is the patron saint of all writers who never had an Oxford or Cambridge education, who are somewhat despised by those who have.
Now I can support that.
Andy, that is actually a huge part of my love for him, is exactly that. The fact that he was so patronised, the fact that he's pretty much been a figure of fun to so many people because he was patronised right from the start.
He's like the full Monty sort of version of literature.
Yeah. I mean, even John's mother, who's a very wonderful reader, she just refers to him as Dirty Harry. Oh, I can't get on with him, Petra, as Dirty Harry.
He didn't care. He just made up the rules. I mean, he wrote 36 books. You know, he died at 44.
Novels,
he was unbelievably productive.
Jeff Dyer says a brilliant thing. It's a very good book, Out of Sheer Rage. One of the things that he does brilliantly is he says, you know what, I don't even really like D.H. Lawrence's novels very much. The essence of Lawrence is in the poetry and the journals and the person.
And the letters. And the aliveness, isn't it?
His book, Studies in Classic American Literature, everybody who's ever written it, I mean, it's a brilliant book of criticism, but it's also got to be the funniest book of criticism. And people think he had no sense of humour. Lawrence had a brilliant
really
sense of humour. He wasn't able to laugh at himself, which is a problem.
I feel a lot of novelists have that problem.
He could laugh at other people really, really well. This is about Walt Whitman. I am he that aches with amorous love. Well, what do you make of that? I am he that aches. First generalisation. First uncomfortable generalisation. With amorous love, oh God, better a bellyache. A bellyache is at least specific. But the ache of amorous love, think of having that under your skin. All that. I am he that aches with amorous love. Walter, leave off. You are. I mean, this is written in, you know, the 20s. You are not he. You are just a limited Walter. And your ache doesn't include all amorous love by any means. If you ache, you only ache with a small bit of amorous love, and there's so much more stays outside the cover of your ache that you might be a bit milder about it. I am he that aches with amorous love. Chuff, chuff, chuff. Choo, 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 chuff. Reminds one of a steam engine, a locomotive. They're the only things that seem to me to ache with amorous love, all that steam inside them, 40 million foot-pounds pressure. The ache of amorous love, steam pressure, chuff.
You know what? I tell you what I find fascinating about Lawrence, based on my reading of The Rainbow and the things that you were reading there. My favourite chapter in The Rainbow is the teaching chapter.
Oh, it's brilliant, yeah. But just as a bit of observation.
First of all, that's as a standalone piece of observation, that really works. But then actually, I really respect him as a writer that for almost saying to the reader, I could do it like this. I could do it in this social realist way, but I don't want to.
No, that's
I want to do something different.
You totally didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
And that's what I love so much about it. One of the things I was looking at my old notes, one of the things that I love that he said, he once said in a letter to J.B. Pinker, he said, tell Arnold Bennett that all rules of construction hold good only for novels which are copies of other novels. A book which is not a copy of other books has its own construction. And that's exactly what he does. It's what he does with this in a way that I think this is sort of the best expression of exactly that ideal, to actually try and do that, to construct a book entirely from people's inner thoughts and feelings, which are not even available to the people themselves. It's an extraordinary act of authorial bravura and ambition and confidence to be able to express the thoughts of somebody who can't articulate those thoughts to even to themselves.
Can we talk slightly a bit as well? Is it an anecdote? But it's quite an interesting anecdote to me. When I was publisher at the Folio Society, we published a centenary edition of Sons and Lovers, 1913, and Colum Toybean wrote the introduction. Colum then went on to give one of those masterclasses that they have at Edinburgh International Book Festival on Sons and Lovers. What was fascinating was that there were quite a few elderly people in the audience who had known the Lawrence family and were complaining about, you know, the people that he'd put in the book. And
oh, my
this,
Lord.
This, 100 years on...
What's the name of the rich family in The Rainbow? He didn't even change the name, and they are to this day reputedly will not discuss Lawrence.
So Colum, who obviously himself writes about where he grew up in Escorthy in Wexford in the Republic of Ireland, had to completely stress this was fiction.
Yeah.
But for them, it wasn't. And I think, again, that's Lawrence the Rebel.
It's interesting him as a novel of a rural life. He writes brilliantly about animals. There's a wonderful scene where Tom Brangwyn, the older, takes Anna, his stepdaughter, out when the mother's having childbirth.
I quote it in the essay.
Yeah, and he goes out into the cow shed, and it's the sort of breathing of the cows and the rhythm of the feeding of the cows and routine, which calms the child's crying down. But it's all amped up to such a level. I mean, Andy's saying about, you know, whether you can get on with the prose or not. It is. I mean, you know, having finished it, you feel like you've been in an emotional tumble dryer. He must have been the most exhausting man to live with.
But of course, he had TB and he died young, and I think that sort of accounts for the prolific nature.
Through it, right? So this is a clip of Aldous Huxley talking about D.H. Lawrence. Huxley knew Lawrence very well in the last... I mean, he knew him for much of his life, but he knew him very well in the last 5 years of his life. And this is a reminiscence of what Lawrence was like, you know, the force of energy that Lawrence represented.
I mean, he was very charming generally. I mean, he would sometimes sort of get cross, but he could be very amusing and entertaining. And he was happy. I mean, he was happy sort of sitting on a stone and remember that poem of Wordsworth's expostulation and reply, sitting on an old grey stone, as he says. And, of course, a lot of his life was spent in this way. And then you would get an urge to write and then write for 18 hours a day. I mean, it was very extraordinary to see him at work. It was a sort of possession. He would rush on this, his hand moving at a tremendous rate, and never correct anything, because if he was dissatisfied, he would start again from the beginning. His capacity for perception it was a great pleasure and instruction, really, to go for a walk with Lawrence. I mean, the sort of way he perceived the world was so intense and exciting.
I don't think all the
Huxley... Wow, so many mind-expanding drugs there, Aldous.
I don't think Aldous Huxley got the Beastie Boys book for Christmas, though, did he? Let's be honest.
Can I just read a great bit of the Jeff Dye book? Because it leads straight on from that. He says, "What is surprising to find that the parts of the correspondence of a great writer I most like are those which would be edited out if any kind of selection were made, i.e. those having nothing to do with his genius and everything to do with his ordinariness and the ordinariness he claimed to loathe. The fact that Lawrence wrote Lady Chatterley's Lover means next to nothing to me. What matters is that he paid his way, settled his debts, made nice jam and marmalade, and put up shelves."
My God, he's Jeremy Corbyn. But I don't want to talk in stereotypes here, but, you know, it's also the mark of an autodidact, surely, the fact that he consumed so much and that he had this extraordinarily work ethic. He just hadn't followed the work ethic of generations before him. He poured it all into being a writer
and creative, and he was so I don't often say this, but he was so brave, really. He just didn't care, and he lived in penury for most of his life. He wrote his way out of it. He was vituperative, but in a very funny... I mean, you know, that some of the letters, when he's taking the piss out of people, I mean, he's brilliant. He had a lot to put up with. But there is that sort of sense that I don't think you can have Lawrence without the fiction, really. But at the same time,
it doesn't
really matter if you... You know, if you want to, I think you can appreciate Lawrence without having to buy the whole of the grand metaphysical scheme.
I was looking for things about Lawrence that I could relate to. What could I find relatable in the modern idiom? And of course, I've got a copy en route, but it didn't arrive in time. I was hoping to read an extract from a book called D.H. Lawrence, The Croydon Years.
Well, I was going to
bring that up because he's
discovered
by
Nietzsche.
Helen Cork. Exactly.
Like he discovered
Nietzsche
Margaret,
in Croydon Public Library.
He discovered Nietzsche. He, the great British acolyte of Nietzsche, discovered it in the Croydon Public Library in December 1908, because he was working as a teacher in the Davidson Road School in Croydon from October 1908 to December 1911.
That's it.
And he also, the long-term listeners will know of my evangelical Croydon streak. But he also mentions the Swan and Sugarloaf pub in a story called The Witch a la Mode. The Swan and Sugarloaf pub is now a Tesco Express. But
in
the 80s, it's where my friend Mark Webb had his 18th birthday party.
There you go.
And the DJ refused to play 25 O'Clock by the Dukes of Stratosphere at his own birthday party. I think that's one of the reasons why I like that section of The Rainbow so much. Actually,
the teaching.
The teacher, if he wanted to, and he didn't want to, which I respect. And as you suggest, Rachel, the sheer insolence, actually, of saying, "I am going to animate this woman called Ursula. I am going to flow through this character."
The meeting of the.
Had he wanted to, it's like all the great painters. Had they wanted to paint a formal portrait, they could have done that, but they didn't want to.
Yeah.
They wanted to do
something
different.
It's one of the things, when I was doing my Lady Chatterley research and all that, there was a point at which he wrote a letter saying, "I just want to write this book and fling it in the face of the public." Those were the exact words. I'm going to fling it in the face of the public. And you sort of think, at that point, you know, in the mid to late 20s, you know, how he had that much energy left, I don't know, you know, but he did. And he rewrote that book 3 or 4 times so that he could get to the point where he felt it was flingable and explosive enough that it would make a difference.
Were the books widely read in his lifetime?
No.
No, because, well, obviously quite a few of them were banned. And yeah. and that I actually think it'd be interesting to talk about why he has fallen out of fashion now. When I studied English literature at university, he was absolutely on the syllabus.
Yeah.
We had to read Lawrence. I wrote one of my dissertation essays on a short story or novella called The Ladybird, The Fox and the Captain's Doll.
Yeah.
And now he's not taught, and he isn't part of, as far as I'm aware, part of the curriculum. I think almost every one of us here would have had to read him at school. Mm-hmm. I think that's the case. I think it's very interesting in the way that we are appreciating working class writers much more, that Lawrence should be dusted down and brought back to life.
Well,
he was a pioneer.
I asked a friend of mine who works in the department that is responsible for the books that get onto the curriculum about why Lawrence why Lawrence had been so popular when we were young as to be taught. Right. Mm. And had then fallen out of favour. And he said a really interesting thing. He said, it's because, this is his opinion, not fact. He said, I think it's because in the 60s and 70s, as you suggest, Catherine, Lawrence was seen as the ancestor of working class writers like Alan Sillitoe and David Story,
yep.
who were considered important enough that we needed to go back and see where they had come from.
Yeah.
Whereas, in fact, once we get into the 80s and that generation recedes, Lawrence is seen as being an anachronism.
Yeah.
And so he has no relevance to the literary scene of
not only his style,
today.
But also his
two other things. Really important is that F.R. Leave is the most influential critic of his generation. Raymond Williams, perhaps the second most, are both massive Lawrence fans. So in terms of canon building, Lawrence is put, in the middle years of the century, Lawrence is put by Leavis because he sees him as a kind of English Freud, you know, thinks he's the great sort of, the novel, the bright book of life. He's the final flowering of the great tradition of the English novel. Raymond Williams, because he saw him as a working class writer, he was engaging with a kind of trailblazer. But then everything, the Sexual Politics by Kate Millett is published in 1970. And I mean, you begin to see then that the wheels start to fall off the Lawrence bus, because he is very susceptible, particularly if you take all his work. I mean, I think the novel's less so, but he says some pretty terrible things that, on one route, whatever that law is that you end up talking about Hitler, that his ideas, movements in world history, European history, not a great book. But, I mean, he opens himself up to the worst kind of, on one level, blood and Bowden kind of fascism, and on the other level, feminism. Feminism sees him as a misogynist.
He pops up in The Intellectuals and the Masses, particularly by John Kerry. This is a thing that he wrote to Blanche Jennings in a letter in 1908. A bit mean of me to read this out, but blame Professor Kerry. If I had my way, I would build a lethal chamber as big as the Crystal Palace, with a military band playing softly and a cinematograph working brightly. Then I go out in the back streets and main streets and bring them in, all the sick, the halt and the maimed. I would lead them gently, and they would smile me a weary thanks, and the band would softly bubble out the hallelujah chorus.
I watched the David Koresh Wacko documentary the other night. It's not entirely dissimilar.
To be fair to Lawrence, he's not being singled out by Carey in that book. It's to make the point that the intellectual trend in the early years of the 20th century
was to exterminating the mass
of suburbia, the mass of lower middle class, Forster, H.G. Wells, etc., etc.
Guess who this is? This might surprise you. I don't know about women in marriage. One thing I do think, that if we'd known as many women as we've read books by D.H. Lawrence, we should have a clearer idea of the situation. To get down to the facts of women for oneself, I think it must be necessary to know many women. There is such a jumble of fancies and ideas about them in one's head that to fly to the first one you encounter and only experience that, how can you test what's true and what's most valuable? I do think D.H.L. went deeply into all this. I don't think he ever drew any conclusions, but that are really dependable. I mean, he never resolved the quarrel between the necessity and beauty of being united with a woman one loves and the necessity of not being entangled or bullied or victimized or patronized or many of the other concomitants of love and marriage.
If that's not Philip Larkin, I'll eat my hat. No, but Larkin, the thing about Larkin, really interesting with Lawrence. Larkin loved Lawrence's poetry. Larkin thought Lawrence's poetry was some of the greatest poetry of the century. Yeah. but he struggled with the novels. Again, this is this fascinating thing, right?
Like Hardy, who I would argue is as great a poet as he is a novelist. I think that, and again, that sort of Lawrence, I would say exactly the same. You know, you almost, you're not exactly reading two different writers there, but I think the poetry has stood up in some respects where some of the novels have fallen down. I'm not thinking about Kangaroo specifically, but... And that is a testament to his extraordinary productivity and his genius,
like. I think you're right about the punch. I mean, I don't think the novels after Women in Love really stand up to much. There's always good things in all of them.
It strikes me that Lawrence is...
Apart from Chatterley.
But we don't want to get diverted onto Chatterley, but I would defend that book even. I mean, it's got some absolutely dreadful bits in it, but it, in terms of being an absolute thing that he wanted to say and do, it is exactly what he wanted to say and do. It's a piece of work that he made with a purpose, and he did subject it to this rewriting and making it fresh. And that's the thing about when you just mentioned Kangaroo and those shorter novels that he sort of bashed out quite quickly and never did that rewriting on. Whereas The Rainbow is something that took him a long time and was, you know, and Women in Love.
It's very important to him that those...
It was very important that they became alive in his hands. It was that was what he was trying to do, to make the writing come alive.
You know what? It really reminds me of... this is self-parody, me saying this, but it's true. It really reminds me of that brilliant Neil Young thing, where Neil Young's response to people saying, well, I like this record, I didn't like that record, is to go, well, it's all one song.
Yeah.
And the thing with Lawrence is, in a sense, you're missing the point. I would be missing the point if I was going, well, I didn't like this novel. It doesn't matter. It's the essence of the thing. It's the flow of the ideas. It's the flow of energy.
That's absolutely right, Andy. That's a very good way of putting it.
Do you think he will come back?
I don't know. If nothing else, I just hope that people read the letters and the journals. No, I hope that people read... I do hope that people read the poetry. And if you can cope with the prose, as Andy said, then, you know, there is... so much that's good in the novels. The 500 pages of The Rainbow, there are some unbelievably, I see now, turgid passages. But, this, you know, some of the scenes, like when the father goes and gets the brothers and they do an impromptu kind of carols under the married couple's window on the back lawn. And the mad speech he gives at the wedding. There's some
wonderful bits. I mean,
I just love that you can have this in a 1915 novel. It's a letter that Ursula sends to Skrebensky after the end of the book. She's basically, it's all about will Anna and Skrebensky get married, and without giving too much away, it doesn't because nothing is ever, like I say, nothing's ever stable in a Lawrence novel. But the letter she sends is lovely. I keep living over again the lovely times we have had, but I don't think you liked me quite so much towards the end, did you? You did not like me when we left Paris. Why didn't you? I love you very much. I love your body. It is so clear and fine, and I'm glad you do not go naked, or all the women would fall in love with you. I am very jealous of it. I love it so much. It's taken the English novel quite a long time to get anybody who can write about sex that openly and clearly.
I think that's why it didn't seem anachronistic to me to reread this book, because you said you found yourself caught up in a maelstrom of emotions and you've been through the ringer when you finish reading it, but actually how true to life and many relationships that is.
I think
you've basically, by the end of this, you've lived through
three
marriages, affairs, kind of, it's, and you are exhausted. It's sort of... It is in a good way.
he nods soulfully. Hey, quickly before we finish, I just want to go around the table and ask, do you have a favourite word that D.H. Lawrence uses repeatedly?
I do, yes.
Okay, yeah, so yeah. I do. Okay,
I wonder if it's the same one.
Okay, no, Catherine, you go first. What's yours?
Loins. I'm not saying it's a favourite, but it's the one that springs to mind immediately when I think of D.H. Lawrence.
Suave loins of darkness. Inchoate.
Oh, yes, he likes inchoate. Yeah. Yes, that's true. Yes, all right. I love his... There's two, right? So, first of all, fecund.
Yeah, he loves
fecund.
He's an embarrassingly fecund writer, right? That's
right. And maximum. He's got this weird thing with maximum, where he uses it as the maximum amount. He'll say, like, Sunday was the maximum day.
I think he was schooled in Latin.
You know, But what I also like about him, all these things I like in principle.
Oh, Andy.
No,
you're coming around to
it. I love the idea that he has particular words that just do it for him. That he's writing and it's basically pouring out of him, and he doesn't want to revise, he doesn't want to go back. He's like, and he has to get it out, right?
Yeah, it's like a sort of there's a wonderful description in The Rainbow of somebody describes somebody else as a running stream, and the person who's listening goes, "Oh, that's what my wife is like. She's like a running stream." And it's a sort of it's the little moments of understanding that burst all over the place, which is sort of it's so touching and so kind of
like fireworks.
Yeah.
And when he wants to do character, Can Gudrun says she would have no truck with tame cats, nice or not, because she believed that they were all only untamed cats with a nasty, untrustworthy habit of tameness. that's very good, very lovely. Well, look, I think we have covered the ground. We didn't read too much from the book. It's there, the whole quivering edifice of Lawrence's work, his poetry and his
quivering
novels.
Quivering comes up a lot.
Quivering, yeah. I think you're right, Catherine. I think worth looking at, particularly with the increased attention this year on working class writing and people from working class backgrounds. He was a trailblazer, a remarkable trailblazer, and as I say, still gets people proper riled up. Anyway, that's all we have time for. Huge thanks to Rachel and Catherine, to our producer Nikki Birch, and to our sponsors Unbound.
You can download hundreds of other shows, plus follow links, clips and suggestions for further reading on our website, backlisted.fm. And of course, you can still contact us on Twitter, Facebook and Boundless. If you've enjoyed this, ponder the pros and cons of leaving a review with stars optional on iTunes or Spotify or wherever else you obtain your podcast-shaped inspiration.
Look, we have come through. See you in a fortnight.
I would let my wife and servants read D.H. Lawrence.
Very magnanimous of you.
Well done.
If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole two extra episodes of what we call Locklisted, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.